Douglas Kennedy, good evening.
Good evening.
I'd like to ask you a few questions about your latest novel, The Moment, which tells the story of a young American writer, Thomas Nesbitt, who goes to Berlin to write a travel book. Mm-hmm. I guess you did a lot of research about Berlin during the Cold War. The wall is almost a character in the book. Why did you choose to tackle that particular period of history?
I've always used cities as people. Mm-hmm. In the Pursuit of Happiness, New York, London, in a special relationship. I was doing the French translation there. Also, here comes a glass of wine.
Oh, please.
Go on. Here comes a glass of wine. Out of the box, so if I fall over dead, you'll know it's not good. But I was in Berlin in 1983. I had a fellowship from the Goethe Institute. I was actually in the West, but I came to travel into Berlin. I thought it was extraordinary. What was most extraordinary, of course, was you were flying into essentially a closed city, mm-hmm. And the wall was there from the plane. I described that in the novel. And it was the first time I crossed over into a communist country. I visited six subsequently. You couldn't travel much in East Germany, because there were very strict restrictions, and you got what I called the Cinderella visa at Checkpoint Charlie. You had to be out by midnight, or the mm-hmm. Volkspolizei and the Stasi would turn you into a pumpkin, I guess. Years went by, the wall came down. I became a writer, a proper writer. I was writing then, but a proper writer. I then found an apartment in Berlin, in Prenzlauer Berg, and ich spreche Deutsch auch. I started spending time there. I was going through a divorce, mm-hmm. and I started thinking very much about regret in life, and things began to come together, and also just the way I could traverse the city now freely. I remember going to the Schiller Theater one night, you know, and leaving my flat in Prenzlauer Berg and doing this trip, which would have required crossing international boundaries. Mm-hmm. Some years earlier, and it was just part of the same city, and how history has a tendency to eradicate itself. People forget about the Cold War, especially if they're younger. Mm-hmm. I think people under the age of 40 have very little cognizance of what that was all about. So I wanted to go back to that, but also to actually write, like The Pursuit of Happiness, a story of two people who fall in love, but there are outside circumstances, larger political circumstances, mm-hmm. that destroy things.
What about that arty community with Alistair, who becomes a very important character as the historian folds?
I invented that completely. Yes. But, I mean, you know, I'm a novelist, I have an imagination. Everyone always expects that if you write something, it actually comes out of your own life. If you've read The Big Picture or L'Homme qui veut vivre sa vie, I mean, I never killed one of the lovers of my ex-wife with a bottle of wine, a special relationship in Relation dangereuse. I've never had a postnatal depression. Similarly, although I did not live in Berlin in the early 80s, I had artist friends who were there, and I knew some of the people. So I invented all that and that life in Kreuzberg, and I did have an artist friend who was Irish, who lived in Kreuzberg, but he was very different to Alistair. But I knew people like Alistair. So, but that was very much a part of life there. I mean, people came to Berlin, Germans came to Berlin from the West to West Berlin, because if they lived there, they could avoid military service. Mm-hmm. And people came there because it was cheap, and it was sort of demi-monde, mm-hmm. And also it was edgy. I mean, that was the other thing about it. You were in a very confined space. You could only travel so far. And that made for a very interesting place.
Mm. I was real interested also by that woman Thomas Nesbitt meets on the plane when going to Berlin, mm-hmm. Who's obviously a very bitter and skeptical woman. Is she a sort of warning for what's going to happen to Thomas?
Well, I think what's always interesting, and it's very true, is, you know, everyone carries baggage with them. And also, if you drop yourself into a kind of complex city, and you go to work for a propaganda unit of the West, of essentially America, which is sort of based on Radio Free Europe, I call it Radio Liberty in the book, you're dropping yourself into the middle of something very complicated. The thing is, when you visit a place, you can never really feel you belong to it. I've lived in Paris now for off and on for 12 years. I speak the language fluently. This is one of the rare times I'm not, because I'm doing this for English teachers. I am probably the best-selling American writer in this country now, and, you know, I've been treated wonderfully and decorated and all that. I would never think I was part of it, because I'm not. I'm not French. One of the reasons I went back to reside part of the time in America and to buy a house there and set up a life there was I felt that was my argument, the United States. It's in all my books. But also I'm an American, and I wanted to be part of the argument again. Thomas makes the mistake of actually thinking he can control a situation which is really outside of everybody's control, especially when espionage comes into the plot.
Well, actually, you used the word hubris in the last chapters. Is he a sort of tragic hero in the classical sense?
Well, I think he's tragic because two things happen without wanting to reveal the entire game away. I think Freud is very right. You know, we are all essentially shadowed by our childhood. And fundamentally, you never get away from that. It's why people make the same mistakes over and over again, especially when it comes to love. He's someone who's desperate for love, but because of his childhood, doesn't feel it's possible. And then he discovers it for the first time with that force. And I think the book really captures what it means to actually fall in love for the first time, where you have this absolute driving, overriding sense, this is it. And then it goes very wrong. And instead of actually listening to what Petra, his lover, is trying to tell him, he reacts hubristically, and he basically, as Alistair says to him, destroys his life. And he's never gotten over it. And his entire life since then has been shaped by that. I think that happens a lot. I really do. I think people, you know, when you're young as well, I know this now because I'm a man in my 50s and divorced, and, you know, I've had a life. You don't know anything in your 20s. You really don't. People think they do. You have to think you do. You think you're actually aware of the world, but you know nothing because you haven't been beaten up by life as yet. And life will beat you up. That's one thing that's very sure. I said this to my daughter recently, who's 16, you know, and who has been going through the usual adolescent stuff, but she's an extremely smart and intelligent and thoughtful young woman. And I just said, look, there are aspects of life which are just rubbish, to use a nice Anglicism, and sometimes when life is profoundly unfair. And also where you're going to meet people who don't like you, you know, and who don't rate you, and who will put you down, and all that. And there's the other aspect of life which is quite miraculous and interesting. And how you kind of, in a way, struggle with that determines so much. I'm sure you know people who are always negative. Or they're always saying things are difficult. It's like half the people I know in Paris who always say, oh, je suis crevé, you know. I have friends where everything is always difficult. You don't have to be happy all the time. I think that's nonsense, because a lot of life is not happy. But I think you owe it to yourself to try to have an interesting life and remain curious. And to look upon life very much as an adventure, where you don't really know the plot.
One question about plots and writing. At some point, Thomas says, when I write, there is an order to things. I am in control, except that's a lie. And throughout the book, writing is seen as a sort of therapy of alleviation. Mm-hmm. Is that how you feel personally
Absolutely.
About writing?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Even though this is not a story from my own life, it's not autobiographical, it's not a roman à clé, it's a very personal book. And certainly, I was writing this, as I said before, in the middle of a very difficult divorce, which I wanted after 25 years, but nonetheless was hugely difficult and unpleasant as well. It got very nasty. So, in a way, I was writing very much about keeping my own equilibrium in a very difficult situation, even though that doesn't come in whatsoever to the book. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, Sartre had a point when he said, l'enfer c'est les autres, hell is other people. But the biggest hell on earth usually is yourself, Swamin. The thing is, when you write, you can control things. When I write, I can punish the wicked. I can make things right. I can make things wrong. Generally, I make things wrong, if you know my books. I can pose all sorts of moral questions. I can determine how things turn out. That's not life. Life is very different, because there are other people. And also, there's yourself. I said this to someone very recently. I think the hardest question in life is one of the simplest. What do you want? Qu'est-ce qu'on veut? What do you want? That's enormous. And it's very hard for people to answer that. When I pose that to people, I often see people actually go like this, this shudder, because it hits them, because they don't know. And most of us don't know. I think if someone says, I really know what I want, I'm always dubious. I don't like certitude in people. I like people who actually see things in a gray way, rather than black or white, Manichaean. I think that's dangerous. That's George W. Bush.